You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. And tip of the hat and thank you to David Sirota for filling in for me yesterday while I was at the Talkers Convention down in New York City on the Rumble panel debating, I don't know, 8 or 9 conservatives. It was wild. Anyhow, it's Friday. It's the first hour of our Friday program, which means it's time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, the guy I think of as America's senator, although having been a Vermonter for a decade, I know Vermonters think of him as their senator, and rightly so. His website, sanders.senate.gov. You can get his newsletter there, the Bernie Buzz. Also, you can sign his petition to overturn, or his, excuse me, constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. A lot of great stuff, and it's a great news source. Senator Sanders, you there?
I'm right here, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Bernie. Great. Great to have you with us. I understand that you had, first of all, Wisconsin. We haven't talked about that since it happened. And also that you had a meeting with Ben Bernanke.
Well, let's talk about Bernanke first, and then we'll get to Wisconsin. There was a meeting of the Joint Economic Committee, which is constitutes members of the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. I'm on that committee. And every so often, Bernanke comes before that committee to talk about economic issues. The issues that I raised with him have to do, number one, with conflicts of interest at the Federal Reserve. One of the functions of the Federal Reserve is to regulate Wall Street, and it has always seemed to me a bit absurd that you have the Federal Reserve itself dominated by bankers, especially the regional feds, including the New York Fed. So you have a guy like Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of the largest financial institution in America, J.P. Morgan Chase, sitting on the New York Fed, which is regulating the large financial institutions. Now, that may make sense to some people. It doesn't make sense to me. It is a very clear example of the fox guarding the hen house, and obviously not doing a particularly good job doing that. So that's an issue we talked about. The other issue that I think has got to be addressed is the size of and the financial strength and impact on its economy of 6 financial institutions owning assets equivalent to 2/3 of the GDP of the United States of America. That's $9 trillion. These 6 financial institutions, led by J.P. Morgan Chase, issue 2/3 of the credit cards in the United States and half of the mortgages, and they absorb about 40% of the deposits.
Wow.
So you have a handful of financial institutions with unbelievable economic and political power. These guys spent about $5 billion over a 10-year period in lobbying and campaign contributions in order to deregulate Wall Street, which led us into the recession that we're in right now. And the irony here is that after we bailed them out 4 years ago, 3 out of the 4 are now larger than they were before we bailed them out because of too big to fail. So I happen to believe that we're really not going to make the kind of progress we need in ending the decline of the middle class and turning our economy around until Wall Street, until our financial institutions stop being gambling casinos where they make huge amounts of money for themselves, but rather be an instrument which invests in the productive economy, in small businesses, which are creating goods and services and jobs that the American people believe. So the need, in my view, to break up these huge financial institutions, create a financial system which invests in the real economy, is a huge, huge issue which has got to be addressed. Another issue that we dealt with in the last week is I had a press conference yesterday with Elijah Cummings, a congressman from Maryland, and we introduced the most comprehensive dental legislation ever introduced in the United States. You know, we talk a lot, Tom, about the health care crisis and, you know, 50 million people without health insurance and people dying because they don't get to a doctor. We don't talk enough about dental care. You got something like 130 million Americans who don't have any dental insurance. Often that dental insurance, if they do have it, doesn't cover their dental needs. We don't have enough dentists. We have dentists who do not take patients on Medicaid. We do not have enough dentists in rural areas where they're often needed. Medicare does not cover dental care. Medicaid often does not cover dental care, depending on the state. So what we have done is put together a comprehensive piece of legislation which makes sure that everybody in this country, the children, the elderly people, one quarter of people 65 years of age or older in this country have lost all of their teeth. A lot of the kids don't go to the dentist when they should. So this is a pretty sweeping and comprehensive legislation that says we're going to address a very serious crisis in this country. Another meeting that we had just yesterday, I am an independent and I caucus with the Democrats, and at my request, Senator Reid put together a meeting to deal with senior issues, and that we had in there Max Richman, who is the head of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the large senior and one of the very good senior citizen organizations in this country, Nancy Altman, who's head of a seniors coalition, which has a whole lot of members, to talk about how we protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and in my view, how we move to a deficit reduction in a way that is fair and not on the backs of the elderly, the sick, the children, and the poor. Because as I said many, many times, Tom, the major issue that we're going to be dealing with in the next 5 months or so is this issue of deficit reduction. Our Republican friends want to decimate Social Security and virtually every other social program of importance to the American middle class. I'm afraid that too many Democrats are moving closer to that point of view. And what we have got to say is, yeah, when you have a deficit caused by two wars that Bush started that were unpaid for, tax breaks for billionaires, and the recession caused by Wall Street greed, we're not going to balance the budget on the backs of the most vulnerable people in this country. We are going to ask the wealthy and large corporations to stop paying their fair share of taxes. We are going to ask the military for cuts, because right now as a nation we spend more on defense than the rest of the world combined. So there is a way to go forward in terms of deficit reduction that's fair. There is a way to go forward that is fundamentally unfair. And that's going to be one of the great struggles we face in the next 5 or 6 months.
And your thoughts on what happened in Wisconsin?
Well, obviously what happened in Wisconsin was very, very disappointing to me, and I think to a whole lot of Americans. I really want to give a real pat on the back and a real sense of gratitude to the thousands and thousands of people in Wisconsin, the trade unionists and others, who did a fantastic job at the grassroots level. At the end of the day, for a variety of reasons, I think mostly having to do with the fact that Walker substantially, I think it was 8-1, outspent Barrett.
And that's just the money we know about. I mean, we may learn
right.
A year from now that it was 30-1.
That's right. And I think what we have seen in Wisconsin is the beginning of what Citizens United, or in the case of Wisconsin, a variation of Citizens United, it was a local quirk in their election laws, means. And what we now have as a result nationally of Citizens United is an absurd Supreme Court decision which says that if you're a corporation, for First Amendment rights, you can be treated as if you were a person. And that means that you can spend as much as you want, unlimited, without disclosure, on campaigns from the White House to the Senate to the House and way on down. And I think this is an incredibly destructive Supreme Court decision which must be overturned, which is why we've got a constitutional amendment to do just that.
And you can get to that at sanders.senate.gov. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls next in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website. You can sign on to that constitutional amendment over at sanders.senate.gov, G-O-V. No, it doesn't come easy. You got to work at it. It's called democracy. Welcome back. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us from his offices in Burlington, Vermont tonight. Andrew in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom and Bernie. My question is with the Greece meltdown. Now, do you think that the Greece citizens knew what was coming as it was coming up, or was it a two-part question here? Do you think they knew it was coming, or was it kind of like they were just in water that was being brought to a boil, or do you think that they kind of had a kind of an ability to see what was coming, and do you think that we're currently in the same situation?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a complicated question. I don't know that we have the time to go into it in great length. But this is what I would say. What the recent elections in Greece were about were people saying very loudly and clearly. And by the way, we had similar elections in France. We had similar elections, statewide elections in Germany, where people are saying, we are moving in Greece. Obviously, the economic situation is awful. And in France and Germany, not so bad, but not great. And people are saying, yeah, we may need some austerity. We may need to cut back. But you cannot just simply cut back on a middle class and working class that has already been decimated, especially in the case of Greece, where you've seen pension cuts and healthcare cuts and job cuts and massive unemployment. And people were saying that pain has got to be spread around to other people, including the upper income people and the banks. And I think, Andrew, the fight that we are seeing in Europe is exactly the same fight that we are going to see in the United States. And that is especially in our country, where we have a grotesquely unequal distribution of wealth and income, where in the last number of years, the wealthiest people in this country have done phenomenally well. So that in 2010, for example, the last year we have statistics on this, 93%, I want you to think about this, 93% of all new income created between 2009 and 2010 went to the top 1%. You have the top 1% owning 40% of the wealth in America. Now, who do you think should be asked to bear the burden of austerity? Do you think it should be elderly people on $15,000 a year who should see cuts in Social Security? Or senior citizens should see cuts in their Medicare? Or kids who don't get enough nutrition now see cuts in nutrition programs? Or do we ask the wealthy and large corporations to start contributing to deficit reduction? You're seeing that fight in Europe. You're seeing it in the United States, and that is going to be the issue I think the whole world is going to be focusing on in the coming months.
Rob in Minnesota, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for this time, Tom. Senator Sanders, I got the greatest respect for both of you. The one question that I've got is this mantra as far as the Republicans in the last 48 hours, again, they came out with this job creators situation. We've got to be able to extend these things. After 11 years of tax cuts to the job creators, we have the worst economy that we've had since I've been alive. I'm 58 years old. Now, the whole thing is why doesn't somebody just come out and tell those people it's not working? Let's go on. I'm willing to pay more taxes.
You're talking about the Bush tax cuts.
I'm in the peasant class.
Rob, it's not a question. We tell them that every day. This is not an intellectual debate. This is, Rob, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think a lot of people are under the impression, are these people stupid? Don't they understand? We had this Romney-Bush economic philosophy of giving tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, what's called trickle-down economics. It didn't work. It was terrible under Bush. We lost 500,000 private sector jobs after 8 years of that philosophy. It simply makes the rich richer and is destructive to the middle class and working families. This isn't an intellectual debate. What this is a debate about, Rob, is that these wealthiest people, the very wealthiest people with incredible money, with incredible power, they don't give a damn. They're not staying up nights. They don't have any concern about worrying about the children of this country, about the elderly people, about the middle class of this country. What their track record has been, these so-called job creators, at the heads of large corporations, they have created jobs in the last 10 years. In China, in Vietnam, in another low-wage countries around America. But in this country, they have downsized considerably. That's been their effort. And in terms of taxes, what they are saying, I don't care if kids go hungry. I don't care if the elderly people can't afford health care. What's only important to me is that I'm worth $100 million. I want to be worth $150 million. I got $5 billion. I want $10 billion. So what you're looking at now is unparalleled greed in this country. It's not an intellectual debate. They got it. They want it. And they want even more. And they're willing to stop at nothing to get even more. That is the sad story. And I know that some people say, gee, is that really right? Maybe they just don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. And what they are doing is working for them. Just mentioned a moment ago, last year we have records. 93% of all new income went to the top 1%. That is fantastic. That is great. That is a success story if you are in the top 1%. But if you're at the bottom 60%, bottom 40%, the likelihood is you're working longer hours for low wages. Not so good for you. But they got the wealth, they got the power, and they are using that.
Yeah. And they're using it to get their buddies elected now. And
That's the other manifestation of that through Citizens United. It's not just brute economic force. It's not just breaking unions. It is now political power because they can contribute as much as they want to right-wing candidates. Yeah.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz there, his newsletter. You can great news source, plus you can sign his constitutional amendment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by TomHartman.com, drop into our free live chat room, hang out with the finest minds on earth, read our message boards, participate, create your own blogs, all kinds of cool stuff. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. And Bernie, you're still here with us, right?
I'm right here.
Okay. Peter in New York, New York, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
We hear you fine, Peter. It sounds like you're driving.
Yes, I am. I am. I've been hearing a lot of the quote unquote, the rich need to pay their fair share. And, obviously with the, budget deficit that we have today of over $1 trillion, I think I've seen in many places that if we let the Bush tax cuts expire for the rich, that won't come anywhere close to closing the budget deficit that we have. So I'm wondering, is there a number that actually equates to fair share, or is that basically whatever tax rate it takes to balance the budget? I mean, how much spending reduction do we need versus the tax increases? But really, more importantly, back to my original question, is what is fair share? Is it 50%?
Good. Okay. Peter, that's a fair question, and it's, first of all, it is not, in my view, necessary to move to complete deficit reduction tomorrow. In other words, we have, I think, a $1.2 trillion deficit this year. We have a $15.6 trillion national debt, and we can have a debate as to how long it should take us to move toward deficit, toward a balanced budget. But I don't think anyone thinks you have to do it overnight. What we do want to do is be moving in the right direction. We want the deficit to go down and not up. Second of all, let us remember and never forget, and it's very easy to forget, that when Clinton left office in 2000, we were running a very significant surplus. And in fact, over a period of years, we would have balanced the budget. Thirdly, let us also not forget that the reason we're in deficit reduction today is two wars that Bush waged, forgetting to pay for them, and tax breaks for the rich and the recession that we're in right now. Fourthly, then, the question is, where do we go from here? When you have an effective tax rate, and this is, Peter, what Warren Buffett often talks about. Warren Buffett's the second richest guy in this country, and he points out that his effective tax rate is lower than his secretary's. And in fact, for the wealthiest people in this country, their real tax rates are lower than they have been in decades. Corporations are today contributing significantly less in corporate taxes to the federal coffers than they used to be, than they used to do. There are also major corporations in this country who don't pay a nickel in taxes. So I can't give you an exact answer about where we should be tomorrow, but this is what I do believe. Yes, the wealthiest people in this country have got to pay more in taxes apparently than they're paying today. Of course that means doing away with the Bush tax breaks for the wealthy, but in fact you've got to go further than that in my view. Second of all, you need to do away with the absurdity that we are losing as a nation $100 billion a year because corporations and wealthy people are stashing their money in the Cayman Island and in other tax havens. Thirdly, the idea that companies like ExxonMobil and other oil companies that make huge amounts of money continue to get huge tax breaks is totally insane to my view. So I think when you look at individual taxes, asking the wealthy to pay their fair share, doing away with loopholes in corporate tax law, taking a hard look at military spending, I do believe that you can move toward a balanced budget in a reasonable period of time without balancing that budget on the backs of the most vulnerable, and also including in that budget significant investments in infrastructure, in transforming our energy system, in education. So that's kind of a long answer to a short question, other than to say that I don't think there's any magic formula that anybody has.
But we have done it before.
Yes.
We have done it before. Corky, in Rochester, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
All right, Senator Sanders. You got to get up there and get on the floor and tell all those guys, okay, you win. We're the American middle class. We'll work for what we worked for in the 1980s. And you guys pay in taxes what you paid in the 1980s. Is that a fair deal?
That's a fair deal. I don't think they'll go for it. They'll go for the first half of that, Corky, not the second half. What they will go for, and by the way, let me, you know, I think, Tom, what in a future program, I think what we should do, what I'll do, is just present to our listeners some of the pieces of legislation that our right-wing Republican friends are bringing forth, and I think people will really be shocked. In other words, Corky says people will work for what they worked for in the 1980s. In some cases, that's already taking place. You have young workers today who are making substantially less doing the same work that older workers are doing today. You have people working far longer hours than they used to in order to bring home the same paycheck. But our right-wing friends really want to go further. They got some of them, and I've heard this, who believe that the concept of a minimum wage. Some of us want to raise the minimum wage. These guys don't even not want to raise the minimum wage. They want to do away with the concept of the minimum wage because to them what freedom is about is if you're in a terrible recession and people are desperate and they're prepared to work for $3 or $4 an hour, what's the problem? Pay people $3 or $4 an hour. Why do you need a minimum wage to at least have a certain standard that workers have to receive? So, Corky, these guys want to pay less, but I don't believe they want to go back to the old tax structure where they were asked to pay their fair share.
Rebecca, in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Nice to talk with you. I really enjoy speaking with you. One of the previous callers asked about how we, why don't we let the people in charge know that these trickle-down economics aren't working, that the tax cuts that we've been giving are not creating jobs. Well, I think that that many of us are informed that these tax cuts are not creating jobs by these so-called job creators. We know that. But on the other side, I think the Republicans also know that. How do we get to that middle ground group of people that may not be aware of that? How do we appeal to those independent voters, those independents that aren't listening to Bernie Sanders on one side and Rush Limbaugh on the other side?
Good question, Rebecca. And there's, I don't think, any easy answer. This is what I do think. And Tom and I actually had this experience on this show, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. A very nice woman called up, sounds very nice, working in the postal system, an area that we have paid a lot of attention to, trying to save the postal system. And she called up from Texas, and she said something to the effect, why is the government getting involved in the postal service like they are doing in Medicare? Was that a, remember that question, Tom?
Yeah, yeah.
And she did not know that Medicare, in fact, was a government program and that the Postal Service, while now getting its revenue independently, is certainly still under the aegis of the United States Congress and the President. She didn't know that. There are millions of people who do not know that. They live in areas of the country where the only thing they hear is right-wing radio. The only politicians they hear from are right-wing politicians who say over and over again that tax breaks for the rich is the only way we can go. Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, terrible government programs. The only way we can move toward a deficit reduction is by making terrible, terrible cuts to these useless and wasteful government programs. That's the mantra. That's the rhetoric they hear every single day. And Rebecca says, well, what's the antidote to that? And I'll tell you what the antidote is. The antidote is a strong grassroots movement in which our people are busy knocking on doors, especially to working class people, to lower income people, educating them about what's going on in our country, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, talking a little bit about what other countries have achieved in terms of national healthcare for all, or free college education for young people. Educate people about where we are right now and where we can be as a nation. And we need a massive grassroots movement to do just that, to counteract the fact that talk radio dominates, what is it, 90-95% of the airwaves, Tom?
Yeah, at least.
All right, that they got all these right-wing think tanks and all the big money interests are electing the right-wing politicians. So, Rebecca, that is not a a complicated answer to your question. It's a simple answer, but I think ultimately it is door-to-door. It's talking to our neighbors. It's getting good information out and doing the best that we can to make sure that working families all over this country do not vote against their own interests, do not support candidates who are working day and night against their future.
What do you think of Thomas Frank's theory that the main thing that swings them is social issues? They forget the economy.
I don't believe that. My own experience in the state of Vermont is, look, you know, we all have differences of opinion, all right? I am pro-choice. I have friends who are not pro-choice. I believe in gay marriage. People disagree with me. But I think you can bring people together around saying, should we have a strong middle class in America?
Yep.
And should we have health care to all people? So I think the people can disagree, but I think the economic issues can be a real unifier.
I think you're absolutely right. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls here on Brunch with Bernie. Right after
you're
this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, for all kinds of great stuff, including the Bernie Buzz. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Mike in Colorado watching us on Dish Network, on Dish TV, on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, this is Mike.
Hey, Mike, you're on the air.
Pleased to meet you, Bernie. Tom, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it isn't time just to call a general strike.
Well, Mike, that would be a good idea if it were feasible, but I don't think we have the organizational capability of doing that. But I do think that what we need to do right now is to work as hard as we can to defeat Mr. Romney's efforts to become president. We need a strong grassroots movement to do that. And we need to develop a progressive agenda, you know, Mike, that the average American says, yeah, that's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer. So what does that mean? It means that we're not going to balance the budget on the backs of working families. It means that we're going to move forward toward a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people. It means that we are going to address this awful, awful problem of massive income and wealth inequality in America today, where the top, you know, 1% earn more income than the bottom 50%, and the gap between the rich and everybody else is growing much, much wider. We have to address that issue, because that is not only a fairness issue, it's an economic issue. If working families don't have the money in their hands, they can't go out and buy the products they need and create the jobs that result from that. So you got to deal with that. We've got to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We need to make sure that college education is affordable to our kids. So what we have got to do, in my view, Mike, is develop these types of strong grassroots organizations around a progressive agenda in which the vast majority of the American people say, I agree with that. And we can disagree on abortion. You can disagree on gay rights. You can disagree on anything you want. But at least on economic issues, let's come together and say that we need a government that is working for all of us and not just the 1%. And that is exactly what's happening right now in Washington. You have especially in the Republican House of Representatives, these guys are doing the bidding of the big money interests, and we've got to say enough is enough, and we've got to make the Democrats stand stronger in representing working families as well.
EJ in Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders, and thank you, Tom, for being level-headed in the sea of lunacy. But anyways, I wanted to talk about the austerity, too. It's like watching Fox News the other night. They took, to me, they twisted the recall on Walker, and they basically turned it in as austerity full steam ahead. And then at my level, being a working class, how do we indoctrinate, just like you were saying, Mr. Sanders, with the grassroots, how do we indoctrinate the people and say it's just not working? The austerity, even the statistics are there. They've been there for 30 years.
Well, that's a great question, EJ, and we need folks, we need folks all over the country to be spreading the word that right now, even before federal action, before the Republicans do what they want to do, we are seeing austerity. If you stop and you think and you look at the broad picture, productivity has significantly increased on the part of American workers. We have technology out there which enables our people to be much more productive than they have ever been before. You would think that the result of that increase, improved technology and increased productivity would be, hey, good news. You're making more money and you're working fewer hours. Congratulations. Instead of working 40 hours a week, you're working 30 hours a week. Or congratulations, you've seen a 25% increase in your income because of increased productivity. But we all know that for a wide variety of reasons, including disastrous trade agreements, anti-union activity, etc., the average American worker today is working longer hours for lower wages than used to be the case. So you already have austerity. You have senior citizens who are living in many cases in terrible poverty. I did a hearing on this issue. Elderly people who just don't have the money to even buy the food that they need to stay healthy. You have 22% of our children living in poverty. You have kids graduating college deeply in debt. That's before the Republican plan to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and education, which would make it much worse. So I would say to you, EJ, yeah, I believe in austerity, but maybe it's time for austerity for the wealthiest people in this country and for the largest corporations who are doing phenomenally well. Let them bear a little bit of pain right now rather than some elderly person or some sick child. So we need austerity for the people who have the money and the wealth rather than just for the middle class.
Bernie, we have just a little over a minute left, really not enough time to bring in another caller. Your thoughts on the week and where we need to be going forward from here?
Where we need to be going forward is the following. I am more than aware, and I share these sentiments, that not everybody is enthusiastic about Barack Obama. That in my view, and I think in many listeners' views, there's a lot more that he could have done. But having said that, let us be very, very clear about the alternatives. If Mitt Romney is elected president of the United States, and if the Republicans continue to hold on to the House, and even capture the Senate, what the American people will be looking at is something they cannot even begin to imagine. Things that they have taken for granted will be taken away from them. There will be a level of attacks waged against working families that we have never seen in our lifetime. So I think the immediate task right now is to make sure that Obama gets reelected, to make sure that we elect as progressive a people as we can to the House and to the Senate, and to fight for a progressive agenda to demand that Congress start worrying about ordinary people in this country, our kids and the elderly, and not just the top 1%.
Thank you, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us today and every week. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. Robert Draper has a new book out, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. I got to tell you about a secret meeting that a group of Republicans had back in 2009 that's going to totally blow your mind right after this, and then Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's Anything Goes Friday, so we're going to do Anything Goes, but first, host's prerogative, I guess we'll call it. I have to share this with you. This is incredible. I first saw this, one of the top stories over at Democratic Underground. Somebody had mentioned it on our message boards over at TomHartman.com, and it was all linking back to a piece on Daily Kos posted by Keep 'Em Honest at DailyKos.com. And it's coming out of a new book by Robert Draper. And so, you know, I really want to look into this book. And I'm sure Sean will be talking with him about coming on the program. But the title of the book is Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. And in this, apparently just came out. This is like breaking news. You probably won't read it on the mainstream media because it exposes a Republican conspiracy. And I use that word very intentionally and very explicitly. Back on Robert Draper in his book, he says that there was a meeting on January 20th, 2009. Now, keep in mind, the election is held in November of 2008. The president is sworn into office in January of 2009. Sorry, I don't remember the date that he was sworn into office in 2009, but I was there. In fact, thanks to Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, I was the reporter that was standing closest to President Obama when he was sworn in. We did our show live from the viewing stands there, and we were right up there on the second floor of the portico. I mean, I could have walked 30 feet and shook his hand, except for two Secret Service guys standing between us. But and I was sitting there watching George Bush make all his weird facial gestures when Obama gave his speech. I kept expecting those to show up on the news because I thought it was scandalous that he was basically, he was mocking the president. George Bush was. And Dick Cheney was sitting there in his wheelchair, you know, just kind of looking at the ground like, anyhow. Robert Draper talks about January 20th, 2009, there was this meeting. The two people who were at the meeting who were not elected officials were Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz. Frank Luntz hasn't talked about it in public. Newt Gingrich said after the meeting, he said, "You'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were born." 2012 being the election that ends the Obama presidency. Or, as Keep 'Em Honest says, to translate Gingrich, "You'll remember this as the day we became traitors to the United States." January 20th, 2009, Robert Draper's book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, Frank Luntz, Newt Gingrich met with Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, Eric Cantor, Republican from Virginia, Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, Pete Sessions, Republican from Texas, Jed Hunsling, Republican from Texas, Pete Hoekstra, Republican from Michigan, Dan Lundgren, Republican from California. Those are all congressmen. And then senators, Jim DeMint, the Republican from South Carolina, Senator John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, Senator Tom Coburn, the Republican from Oklahoma, Senator John Ensign, the Republican from Nevada, and Senator Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee. Now, what did this small group of Republicans, along with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, organize themselves to do within a week or so of the president, President Obama, being sworn into office? During the four-hour meeting, and I'm quoting from the Daily Kos piece here, by Keep Them Honest, the title of it, by the way, is Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and Kevin McCarthy Plot to Sabotage U.S. Economy with Frank Luntz. Senior GOP members plotted to bring Congress to a standstill, regardless of how much it would hurt the American economy, by pledging to obstruct and block President Obama on all legislation. Okay, remember, for months at that point, we had been losing 700,000 jobs a month. And it was happening that week, January 20th, 2009. We were losing 700,000 jobs a month. 2 months after this covert meeting, according to this book, 2 months after the covert meeting where they plotted to sabotage the U.S. economy in March of 2009, Congressman Pete Sessions and Republicans, Pete Sessions said the Republicans should follow the model of the Taliban. This, I'm quoting now from an interview with the National Journal in 2009, a conservative publication, where Pete Sessions, the congressman from California, said, quote, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side, in other words, when dealing with Democrats. Congressman Pete Sessions came out of this meeting basically saying Republicans in the House and Senate have to behave like the Taliban. He went on to say, if Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things as they are rather than trying to do something about them. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, after this meeting, actually at the meeting, according to the book, Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, said, we've got to challenge them on every single bill. We have to show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. These men were plotting, and they were all men, plotting to crash the economy of the United States in order to make Obama one-term president. Before Obama came into office, these guys, all of them, voted for the Bush-Cheney bailout of Bail Stearns, for the Bush-Cheney bailout of AIG, for the Bush-Cheney bailout with TARP in September 2008, and then the second Bush-Cheney TARP in October of 2008. They supported Bush and Cheney keeping two wars, declaring two wars and not putting them on the budget, running them up on a national credit card. They supported Bush Cheney spending $4 trillion while giving tax cuts to the top 1%. They had no problem with that. Since then, every person who was in that meeting has participated in threatening to shut down the government, particularly over raising the debt ceiling. And when they did, Eric Cantor and John Kyle, who were in that meeting, they were having debt ceiling negotiations with Barack Obama. They walked out of the negotiations and said, we won't talk about this anymore. That was when America's credit rating was lowered. Senator Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker, the senators who were at the meeting, have filibustered more bills, 300 bills, than any Congress in the history of the United States. They have voted no on every single piece of legislation brought to the floor. They kept their word. We are going to stop everything that the president wants to do. They voted no on every single piece of legislation brought to the floor, including no to Al Franken's anti-rape amendment, no to the Lilly Ledbetter Act, no to the Fair Pay Act, and no to a 2010 bill on, you know, that would stop outsourcing. Representatives, now that was in the Senate. In the House of Representatives, the people who were at the meeting, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, and Dan Lundgren, they have voted no on every single piece of legislation, including a no on increasing FEMA during national disasters. These guys are intentionally sabotaging the United States of America, you, me, and everybody in this country. Right now, they're sabotaging the transportation bill. Why? Because this thing expires at the end of this month, and if they don't pass a renewal of it, 1.9 million people will be thrown out of work. The unemployment rate will go up to 9.5%. Barack Obama will lose the White House. This meeting was on January 20th, 2009, setting up treason.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So my question, is the American press going to report on this traitorous behavior of these Republicans? Okay, you've heard my rant. Now it's your turn. It goes Friday, Adam in Savannah, Georgia. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. In the state of Georgia, we have a board of regents for our university systems that's been put in place by now about 11 years of Republican domination of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And as it stands, they are now targeting our universities like nothing you've ever seen before. For a school to maintain funding, it's no longer based off of your student population. It's based off of the number of students you graduate,
mm-hmm.
which is leading to any of the, you know, junior colleges, two-year schools that transfer most of their students out, they're losing all their funding.
Wow.
And for the schools that are four-year programs, they're being forced to just push students through whether they deserve it or not. Mm-hmm. I actually know three or four faculty members at my university that have either been pushed out or are being pushed out into retirement because they refuse to just pass enough students to maintain funding.
Amazing. This is the law of unintended consequences. I am guessing that that legislation probably even got some Democratic votes thinking, oh, yeah, if a college doesn't graduate people, they must not be doing a good job. Let's dial back on their funding. But as you point out, there are colleges whose job isn't to graduate people. It's to be a stepping stone to colleges that do. And the colleges that do, they really should be flunking some people, you know.
And this is a few years ago, and the students who, say, came in as lower classmen, started taking the core classes, they used to weed them out.
Mm.
They're now going to their upper-level programs and are failing out.
Right. Yeah. It's
either that or, you know, spending 3 or 4 years in a school that they shouldn't have been in to begin with, racking up tons of debt.
Right. That's amazing. That is absolutely incredible. Thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it, and thanks for the call. Andrew in Syracuse. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know that in your long line of work, you've done a lot of work about how children learn, and I have heard that if you read to your child, even if he already can read, he's able to read on his own, but you read to him slightly above his reading level, that it helps along.
Sure.
And so,
that's common sense.
Yeah. And I've done that for years with my two sons, and I pass along that recommendation also because it's a lot of fun. My sons and I have read Treasure Island, Time Machine, Swiss Family Robinson. We just finished up Once in Future King.
Wow.
And
you read the originals. Those are dense reading in the original forms.
Yeah, and Around the World in 80 Days. Anyway, one that we read a few months ago was Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
That's one of my favorite Twain books. In fact, it is my favorite Twain book, and it's one of my favorite books of all time. I read that when I was 9 or 10 years old. My dad turned me onto it.
Well, I read it about 40 years ago, and I read it about 6 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And it's fascinating to read in today's modern context about how Twain discusses the difference between a society where have only rich and only poor, and those who are rich are incredibly rich, and those who are poor are incredibly poor. And the injustice, and the he has these screeds against nobility, and he doesn't use the term unity of church and state, but you see that what he's driving at. He rails against the church, not as a religious institution, but rails against the church as being having political power.
Right.
And it's interesting reading this 19th century author discussing politics and economy in a, I guess, 9th century context,
right,
and then reading it in the 21st century and thinking about it in the way of modern politics.
Wow, so, I'm going to have to reread A Connecticut Yankee. I mean, I remember when the guy, you know, like had a, what, he had a cigarette lighter or a match or something like that, and that was the moment when he convinced everybody he was a wizard. Am I remembering the story right?
Well, I don't recall that part, but I do recall there was he was going to be burned at the stake, and he predicted that the moon is going to blot out the sun.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah.
But he has these this adventure. I think he goes actually with Arthur and travels among the poor, and you know, we see how it works. And in, you know, in terms of justice and forget upward mobility.
Yeah.
And he himself starts building his own economy because he's good at building things. And there's a little romance thrown in.
Sure.
But as I say, I pass that along to you and your readers because, you know, as you and I have both experienced, you read it many years ago and then you read it today, and it's a good refresher.
Yeah. Well, my memory of it, as you can tell, is very, very old. I'll have to check it out. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Chris in DeKalb, Illinois. Hey, Chris, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi. I have a question about the health insurance bill, the Affordable Health Care Act. My fiance is on her dad's health insurance through TRICARE through the military, and they're telling her that she's kicked off at age 23 because they don't have to follow the federal law. All they have, they get their orders directly from the DOD.
That's right. The DOD is exempted from Obamacare.
They're exempted from Obamacare?
Yeah. That's my understanding. I mean, I might be wrong, but if they're telling you that, and that's my recollection too, the DOD operates as its own little world. You know, I mean, it's a socialist paradise here in the United States. They give you clothing, they give you food, they give you a place to live, they tell you what to do. it's kind of communism 101. But they also have their own pension system, their own retirement system, their own pay grade system that is unique from the rest of the federal government and any other institution. And their own healthcare system, you know, TRICARE, as you identified it. So, and they have their own hospitals, which are federally owned, and in fact are far more. I mean, it's the ultimate socialism. The military hospital system is very much like England's socialized medicine. The person to call is your member of the House of Representatives. Call their local office. They'll have a person who does what's called constituent services, and they can tell you for sure if that's the case or not. Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything goes Friday. Got something you want to get off your chest? Give us a shout. We'll be back here in just a moment. This opportunity for you to support your local station. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Sean in Washington State, listening on AM 620. That must be KPOJ. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to push back just a little bit on the whole Thomas Frank issue. You had mentioned, suggested during the Bernie Sanders segment that Tom said that people were voting conservative over social issues. I just want to...
Well, that wasn't the entire argument that he made. That was just a small... That was a piece of it.
Right. The larger argument is that it was only when the Democratic Party stabbed the poor and the working class and the middle class in the back. That's when working class people, poor people, walked away from the Democratic Party. I myself come from a family.
When was that?
Well, I myself come from a family of railroad employees, and we were hurt directly when Jimmy Carter started deregulation. in the late 70s. Carter also sent arms to the Shah of Iran in spite of the murderous secret police. The Shah of
Carter,
Iran was
Carter was funding the Shah of Iran, as was Nixon, as was Ford, as was Eisenhauer, as was Kennedy.
Ronald Reagan came along and pushed NAFTA, and that didn't get through until Gore and Clinton backed NAFTA.
Yeah.
And so it was the Democratic Party stabbing the poor and the working class in the back. That's when they abandoned the Democratic Party, and it goes on.
Nice try, Sean. Nice try. And I know, you know, how you must really get off on getting on a progressive talk radio show and trashing the Democratic Party. But here's the facts. Here are the just, you know, simple facts. The Republicans have been pushing this free trade mantra forever. Yeah, the Democrats got on board with it for a while. But this is principally a Republican thing, number one. Number two, and a libertarian. I mean, the libertarians are like all over this. In fact, libertarians don't even want there to be borders. You know, forget about immigration. Let the rich do whatever they want, number one. Number two, the Republicans stabbed the working class in the back with the Taft-Hartley Act back in 1947, when they said, "No, you want to have a union? No, so states can create their own right to work for less states." The Republicans have been stabbing the working people in the back steadily. I mean, if you look at the last, you know, the last decade during the Bush, the 8 years of the Bush administration, 93% of all the gains in terms of salaries went to the top 1%. Ronald Reagan went after Patco. Let me just say it very, very simply. First of all, you can find individual exemptions or exceptions or things that you can, I can give you a long list of things you can criticize about the Democrats or the Republican Party. But the fact of the matter is that the Republican Party has been the party of privilege and wealth and the party opposed to working people since the 1880s, when it was taken over by the robber barons. Without exception, arguably with the exception of about a three-year period during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency back in the 1900s. And the Democratic Party, particularly since the Kennedy and Johnson presidencies, has been the party that has been standing up for working people in the United States, that's been standing for civil rights, that's been standing for workers' rights, that's been standing for women's rights, consistently. And you've got Republicans now who are going out of their way to sabotage the United States of America. I mean, just sabotage the United States of America. And I don't care how much you're paid to call into a talk radio show, it doesn't cover this fact up. In fact, what it does is it gives me a great opportunity to, again, point this out. January 20th, 2009, 14 traitors to the United States met in a secret meeting to figure out how to prevent President Obama from having a second term. And the way that they were going to do it was by taking you down, this last caller. I'd have to look back at our call logs. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. Taking you down and taking everybody down. These 14 Republicans basically said, to hell with the American worker. Frank Luntz, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, and Newt Gingrich. They met together. You can read it in Robert Draper's new book, Do Not Ask What We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. They met together and committed to block even things like the legislation that Nancy Pelosi got out of the House of Representatives that said, you know that tax break right now that big companies like GE and Hewlett-Packard and Apple and everybody else, these tax breaks that they get if they break down a factory in the United States and ship it to Mexico or Panama or South Korea or Vietnam or China or whatever it may be, that tax break they get, the offshoring of American jobs that is actually, because it's a tax break, it's paid for by you and me, we make up the difference, we're not going to give you that tax break anymore. So not only do you not get a tax break if you're corporate America for offshoring jobs, but if you have already offshored jobs and taken advantage of that tax break, we'll give you another tax break to bring those jobs back home. This was in 2010. A very simple and very straightforward piece of legislation that would have brought home those jobs. The anti-outsourcing bill of 2010 And it was filibustered by Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. And who was in that meeting? Who were the senators? Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. Now, it takes a lot for me to call somebody a traitor. But this is about as damn close to treason as anything I have ever heard of in my life. This is intentional sabotage of the American economy by Republicans. And then they fund everything from people to call in to talk radio shows to people to go scribble on blogs. On you can find it everywhere. Read the blog posts in the New York Times. Read the blog anywhere. There are paid shills out there right now who are paid to promote, to paper over this, to make sure that you don't know that the Republicans are crashing the economy and then gleeful about it. I mean, look at the video the other day from when John Boehner and Eric Cantor came out and said, you know, when the job numbers came out, 69,000 jobs, when these guys, when they were held their press conference, they kept cracking into a smile. Oh, the economy's really bad. It's not quite that bad, but it was so obvious. They were just gleeful. Our strategy is working. And it is working. There's a lot of pain. They said to President Obama, we will shut down the government. We will not fund Medicare, Social Security. We're just going to take it all if you don't cut unemployment from 99 weeks down to 74 weeks. And in order to get just to keep the government going, the president signed that piece of legislation. And now you've got several hundred thousand people who have been knocked off the unemployment rolls. And it's going to be a half a million by November. Because these 14 Republicans made this deal with each other. This deal with the devil. I just find it amazing. Marianne in Seattle. Hey, Marianne, what's up?
Hi. This is scary times. I'm having heart palpitations when I listen to you. Couple of things. One is everyone's talking about an election. This is not an election. It is an auction to the highest bidder.
Yep.
And I don't understand why people don't see this.
Well, they don't see it because you know who benefits from the auction? You know who gets all the money?
Oh, of course. I know.
The TV networks and the TV stations. And they're the ones who most people get most of their news now from TV.
That is, it's so scary.
And the websites who want the advertising?
I'm falling down in a hole that has no end to it. That's how I feel our government is going.
Well, you know, don't. What happens, our government has been corrupted a bit like this before. You know, the last time it happened in a big way was Warren Harding's election in 1920, which led right to Teapot Dome and the whole bit, you know, Albert Fall. And the corruption of government got so severe under those three Republican administrations in the 1920s, Harding's, Coolidge's, and Hoover's, that it led to the great crash, and the housing crash in 1927, followed by the stock market crash in 1929, followed by the Republican Great Depression. And you know, by the way, neither of us are old enough to remember, but I was just reading this in a history book over the weekend, that up until the 1940s, it was referred to as the Republican Depression, not the Great Depression. And it was Republicans who promoted the idea of calling it the Great Depression instead of the Republican Depression. Anyhow, it's these things go in cycles. People, you know, yes, you know, if the Republicans get their way, as Bernie pointed out, there's going to be hell to pay. I mean, it's going to really hurt a lot of Americans. And well, that will bring about change.
I'll be living under a bush at this point. I mean, literally. Number two, there's just one other thing I want to say is the Republicans they want to keep the tax rate for the rich. Okay, I believe in compromise. But why doesn't anyone say, show me the statistics that they, over this period of time that they've had this, that they have increased jobs dramatically?
Well, what they'll do is they'll say, during the Reagan administration, there was much more economic growth than there is now, which is true. And that economic growth did not track the drop in taxes. It tracked the increase in government spending, much of which was borrowed money. But the government, but the Reagan administration dramatically expanded government spending, dramatically expanded the number of government employees, and it didn't just happen at the federal level. It happened at the state and local level as well. And the consequence of that was that the economy was stimulated. And we've seen, actually, over the last 2 years, a reduction in government spending. Paul Krugman has a piece on it today in the New York Times. It's excellent. Thank you for the call, Marianne.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more here on Anything Goes Friday, 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Program, and Victoria Jones. Speaking of smart people, Victoria Jones at the talk of the Talk Radio News Service is at the White House today. And this, by the way, this Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
The president made a statement this morning in the Brady Press briefing room and took some questions. And one of the things that he said was that the private sector is doing fine. Republicans pounced on that statement, and he had an opportunity to address it this afternoon when he was with President Aquino of the Philippines. He was asked a question by a journalist, Mitt Romney, who had said he was out of touch. So he responded, said, listen, it's absolutely clear that the economy is not doing fine. That's the reason I had the press conference. That's why I spent yesterday, the day before yesterday, this past week, this past month, this past year, talking about how we can make the economy stronger. And he then went on to make all the points that he'd made in the press conference this morning again.
Yeah, and his original remark, actually, I'm looking for it right now because I had it. What I'm finding is that all the websites have Eric Cantor or John Boehner, but they don't have Obama's original quote. But his original quote was about three sentences long,
yes.
And it was about how terrible things are.
It was.
But he said, however, we have for 6 or 7 months or something like that?
27 months, we've created 4.3 million jobs.
Right. 27 months, we've created almost 4 million jobs. And so, you know, that's going fine. Well, it's not going fine. That was a poor choice of words, but that
right.
wasn't his point.
It wasn't his point. Greg Sargent in the Washington Post has a very big clip of it today, and he does a very good piece on it. What is interesting is Mitt Romney, who was all over him for saying this and for what's being called his gaffe, himself said something very interesting this afternoon as he talked about what the president said. Because part of what the president was doing, partly he was talking about Europe, partly he was talking about legislation that he wants Congress to pass to put construction workers, police, teachers, and firefighters back to work. So Mitt Romney said this afternoon to the president of Obama. He wants another stimulus. He wants to hire more government workers. He says we need more firemen, more policemen, more teachers. Did he not get the message of Wisconsin? The American people did. It's time for us to cut back on government and help the American people. He seems to be saying that we should not hire firemen, policemen, or teachers.
Right. Well, that is what he's saying.
Yes.
Has this story, this was big on the Daily Kos today and over Democratic Underground and whatnot. There's a new book out by Robert Draper called Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives about this meeting of 14 Republicans on January 20th, 2009, right around the time Obama was inaugurated, where they got together and they intentionally agreed to block all legislation that might improve the economy. This included Senators Bob Corker, John Ensign, Tom Coburn, John Kyle, and Jim DeMint. And then there's a small group of Republican congressmen, including Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor. Is that getting any press beyond the progressive media?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, hopefully it can start. Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz were there, and then these congressmen. And when they came out of this meeting, Pete Sessions actually said that he compared them with the Taliban. He said, he said, we're going to become like the Taliban in an interview with the National Journal in March of 2009. He said, we are going to become the insurgency. Congressman Kevin McCarthy at the meeting said, quote, we've got to challenge them on every single bill, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. This is in 2009. And Newt Gingrich said, and I quote, You'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. And he's talking about the defeat of Obama in 2012. It's amazing.
Astonishing.
It's amazing. So, anyhow, back to you.
Wow. President Obama also talked about the recent national security leaks in response to a question and really seemed very stern and quite angry, actually. I was in the room. He seemed really quite angry. He said, the notion that my White House would purposely release classified national security information is offensive. It's wrong. And people, I think, need to have a better sense of how I approach this office and how the people around me here approach this office. He also said, when this information or reports, whether true or false, surface on the front page of newspapers, that makes the jobs of folks on the front lines tougher, and it makes my job tougher, which is why, since I've been in office, my attitude has been zero tolerance for these kinds of leaks and speculation. And he seemed to be being really quite critical of John McCain in the way that he was saying how I approach this office. People need to have a better sense of how I approach this office. I felt he was talking about John McCain when he said that.
What had McCain said?
McCain has basically said that the leaks have come from the White House. They are politically motivated to help President Obama in November to make him look strong on foreign policy.
Interesting. Well, they have done that for all but, you know, some part of his base that doesn't like, you know, the drone strikes and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, he's going to call probably on Monday for a special counsel. That's what he's indicating he's going to do.
Whoa.
That's what he says he's going to do.
Okay.
Coming up next week in the Leveson Inquiry in England, this is the inquiry into media standards and ethics as a result of the scandal around phone hacking. David Cameron, Prime Minister of Great Britain, Ed Miliband, Leader of the Opposition, George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Liberal Democrat Leader Clegg, also former Conservative Minister John Major, former Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown. They are all going to be giving evidence next week.
About Murdoch?
About their dealings with the media, and in particular Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any evidence yet that this might come to these shores, to the United States?
So far not. So far not.
Fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Coming up next, George W. Bush. There's a clip of George W. Bush you've got to see in here that's going to blow your mind.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, I promised you George W. Bush. And there's a reason why I want to play this, the very short excerpt from George W. Bush's first State of the Union address. This is 2001. And this is before 9/11. And he has inherited an economy from Bill Clinton that is doing well. It was slightly tipping toward recession, but it was by and large doing well. And because of Clinton's increase in taxes on rich people and corporations, and it wasn't huge. I mean, it went up to 39% when you started making, you know, hundreds of thousands, close to $1 million a year. Because of that, the economy was doing so well, we were going to pay off all of the national debt that had been run up by Reagan and George Bush Sr., which is almost all of the national debt. And here's what George W. Bush said at the beginning of his presidency. Now, keep in mind, of course, he didn't go down this road. He talk is cheap. He decided instead to do the two Santa Claus theory, Jude Winiski's theory of, you know, spend like a drunken sailor because you're a Republican president. and then, you know, put that on the corporate credit card or on the national credit card, and then when a Democrat comes into office, yell and scream about the debt, which is, of course, what they're doing. So, but here's George W. Bush talking about the incredible economy that Bill Clinton handed off to him by raising taxes on people, on rich people.
I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history. Many of you talk about
Yeah, now keep in mind, when George W. Bush became president, the national debt was about $5 trillion. $3 trillion of that was Treasury bills that were owned by the Social Security Administration. In other words, it was money that we owed ourselves. It wasn't even money we owed ourselves. It was, you know, the Social Security Administration parking its surplus in a fund that paid a small interest, you know, it made a small profit. It paid interest. So when Bush says, you know, the remaining $2 trillion is paying off all the debt that's possible to pay off, there was only $2 trillion in debt outside of Social Security. And that's not really debt. I mean, that's a surplus. So he was right. If he had just kept doing things, if he had not dropped taxes, which he did the following year, if he had not cut taxes, if he had not declared two wars and put them on the national credit card, and if he had not pushed through a prescription drug piece for Medicare that prevented the government from negotiating drug prices, we'd have no national debt right now. Just think about that. No national debt. But instead, they had to, you know, this was two Santa Claus on steroids. Jack it all up. He came into office with $5 trillion in debt. He left office with $10 trillion in debt. And keep in mind, of that $5 trillion he came in, only about $2 trillion of it was genuine debt. The rest of it was a Social Security trust fund, which actually isn't debt. So we really only had about a $2 trillion national debt when George W. Bush came into office. And, I mean, Bill Clinton had already started paying it down. And you know, he leaves $10 trillion, which is actually eight. They got Social Security to Obama. It's really quite remarkable when you think about it. John in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on TuneIn Radio. Hey, John, what's up?
I'll do it. If I go, I'll go tomorrow morning and come back Sunday night.
Oh, really? John, you're on the air. John doesn't know he's on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom, it's a great honor to speak to you. I've learned so much about you in the last year.
Thank you.
I had two quick things really quick. The guy that called in about the railroad.
What? You mean the guy who called and said that the Democrats stabbed working people in the back and that's when he stopped voting Democratic?
Yeah. He's totally lying because my father's in the railroad. I was in the railroad.
He was talking about Carter deregulated the railroads.
Yeah, basically, I believe in 1985, 86, it was actually Reagan, where his administration, I believe, they lowered there was an agreement where they had a certain, they had to pay you a certain amount for every check. And I believe he cut that because my father, he stayed with his union. His union agreement was intact. And then right after 86, my brother got on about 1990. His agreement was totally different. I mean, everything, all of his cuts, all the pensions were all cut.
Yeah, well, that was the consequence of Ronald Reagan having put in as the head of the Department of Labor somebody who was openly hostile to labor, the first time it had ever happened in the history of the United States. But, you know, John, we have to acknowledge that Jimmy Carter's deregulation of the trucking industry, for example, really ultimately hurt the trucking business. Jimmy Carter's deregulation of the airline industry ultimately really hurt the airline business.
I wanted to bring the point that it was Reagan. It wasn't. He said that it was down the line.
Well, it was both. I mean, Carter, those last 2 years, Carter was doing a lot of good things. Yeah. And he, I think he was one of our best presidents. He was one of the few presidents who was in office and never had a war, never declared a war, never thought, you know, had the need to have a war. And had he not been sabotaged by Bill Casey, by, you know, who was the Reagan's campaign manager, talking to the Iranians and saying, hey, you know, we'll sell you those spare parts that you need for your U.S. provided military if you will keep those hostages. Had Carter not been sabotaged like that by the Republicans, yeah, I think he would have, you know, but there's no doubt he would have won re-election. He was way ahead. And, but, you know, Carter's mistake, in my opinion, was the deregulation of the, right, of a couple of industries, and Clinton's mistake was free trade, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, the whole bit.
I mean,
but, you know, we can be honest about that, but, you know, the fact of the matter, and thank you, John, for the call. The fact of the matter is, though, that in 2010, when Nancy Pelosi tried to make good on fixing Bill Clinton's mistake, And the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted with her on this, and it passed the House of Representatives with a bill that said, you know, if somebody's going to outsource jobs, we're not going to give them a tax break anymore, and if they bring jobs home, we will encourage that with a tax break. When she passed that out of the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the United States Senate fought that because it would have created, over the next couple of years, 3 or 4 million jobs here in the United States. And you can't have that when there's a Democrat in the White House. That's the Republican philosophy. These Republicans, Bob Corker, John Ensign, Tom Coburn, John Kyle, Jim DeMint, Dan Lundgren, Pete Hoekstra, Jeb Henserlin, Pete Sessions, Kevin McCarthy, Eric Cantor, and Paul Ryan, these Republicans who met on January 20th, 2009, to sabotage the Obama presidency by sabotaging the American economy. These traitors. I know no other word. You could say, well, it's partisan. No, this is a level of partisan politics that I don't think we've ever seen in the United States. We have never seen an entire party, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, maybe there's a historian out there who can correct me on this. I know, you know, we've seen a lot of partisan politics. You go back to the XYZ affair with John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. But that was like taking an incident. That was like gotcha, right? That, you know, there's lots and lots of gotcha. Obama says the private sector is doing fine. Gotcha. This isn't gotcha. This is sabotage. These 14 men sat in a room, these 12 members of Congress, 6 members of the Senate, 5 members of the Senate, excuse me, 7 members of the House of Representatives, and Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich sat in a room for 4 hours on January 20th, 2009, and plotted the destruction of the American economy so that Barack Obama would not get reelected in 2012. These guys are playing a long game, and they're playing dirty. And I call that treason.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you've got another word for it, let me know. I would love to hear it. But Robert Draper's new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, lays the whole thing out. Yeah, it's Anything Goes Friday, and Ray in Vero Beach, Florida. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm the fellow who called about 3-4 weeks ago when Bernie Sanders was on, who I've contributed quite a bit of money. Hold on, please. I've contributed about $1,300 to Bernie. I think he's the greatest guy in the world. My question, or not a question, my statement is that these Republican neocons have committed, as you're saying now, an act of treachery.
Treachery is a better word than treason. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for, and a very good one.
The thing is, they have sworn an allegiance and given an oath to Grover Norquist's ideology.
Yes.
They have violated their oath of office to the country.
Yes.
There is no other definition that can be applied to them except that they are traitors. The only question that remains is, to what degree are they traitors? And that brings you back to the first person who was hit with that label, Benedict Arnold.
Right.
Benedict Arnold did not swear allegiance to the United States government because there was no government. There was no flag.
Right. There were several flags, actually, at that point. But, yeah, good point made.
He had none to play. The first thing he did was commit all of his resources and his health and his life and led an attack up the Kennebec River and almost took Quebec.
Yeah.
The greatest fort in North America.
Yep.
He then came down after being paroled and built a navy to oppose the British sloop of war and all of the boats that were constructed by building a navy with farmers and woodsmen on Lake Champlain to defeat the British attack by water.
Yes.
He then, after that success, delaying the invasion, he then created, led the attack at Saratoga, bringing together three different forces, which were the Continentals, who weren't being led by Granny Gates, the New Yorkers, and the Patrons, the Dutch Patrons,
mm-hmm.
and the Over Mountain Boys from New England, under Ethan Allen. And he could relate to them because he was a Mainer. He was a New Englander.
Yep.
At the same time, the guys coming from the West, under Daniel Morgan. Morgan was the guy that was in prison with him in Quebec. So he was able to coordinate three prongs of attack and defeat the British at the largest battle, perhaps the most important in the Revolution. Now that is the definition of a patriot. Whatever he did after that has to be compared to what these people do and have risked. They risked nothing.
Yes.
And therefore I consider them to be worse traitors than Benedict Arnold, who didn't realize that Washington was fighting for his own military life because Congress was being bombarded by generals who were appointed because they were of a higher social standing.
Right. You are obviously a scholar of Benedict Arnold. I am not. What was Benedict Arnold's crime?
Well, he tried to give up the plans for Ticonderoga so it could be captured. After he had been passed over for every field commission, he was hoping for a field generalship.
Uh-huh.
He thought Washington was betraying him, but Washington was barely able to hang on to his own job.
Uh-huh. So he felt betrayed by George Washington, so he committed an act of treason.
Had his own personality problem. But any one of those three campaigns that he led and rescued this country from should have made him. We should be minting coins in this guy's name.
Sure. He put his life on the line a lot for our country. I'm not sure you can say the same for Paul Ryan or Eric Cantor or Kevin McCarthy or Pete Sessions or Jeb. I question
their understanding of the word of true performance of the for the Constitution.
Yeah,
they have denigrated it. As far as I'm concerned, that's it for me. I would like to mention one other thing regarding the economics.
Mm-hmm.
I read an article in 2007 written by a fellow named Daniel Fisher, and it was written in October 16th, 2006, entitled A Dangerous Game. Hedge funds have gotten rich from credit derivatives. Will they blow up?
Oh.
This is an economist. The thing that was amazing about it, it's less than two pages.
Yeah.
I've never seen an economist write anything less than two pages.
Yeah.
It names the methodology from the bundling and the criminality of creating the bundles
right
on up through the CDWs, the credit default swaps.
Sure.
And it names the names, names the people, names the companies and institutions.
Wow.
A fantastic article.
Yeah. Somebody who is prescient.
And in a left-wing paper, a true pinko called Forbes. Forbes
Amazing.
Magazine, October 16, 2006. Okay. It ain't an easy read. You've got to have some background in marketing. Thank you very much. My battery's going dead.
That's okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Ray. I just made a note of that. I'm going to try and track it down. I appreciate the call. George in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, George, minute to the break. What's up?
Well, Tom, it's nice to hear from you. Are you there?
I am.
Okay.
Thanks for
calling. Well, Tom, conservatism and preserving and conserving, politically conserving, has nothing to do whatsoever with fiscal frugality and never has. If you trace the history of Tom DeLay and Trent Lott and compare that with Dennis Kucinich and Ted Kennedy, it shows you that the so-called conservatives outspend their progressive liberal Democrat, the counterparts about 2.5 to 1. And political conserving is all about preserving the status quo and keeping economic and political power in the hands of those who have it. And I hope that January 20th meeting talked about can actually be exposed in mainstream media sometime.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I mean, if Robert Draper is no slouch, and he's written this book that lays it out, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, and lays this out, I'm just aghast. I'm just horrified by it. George, thanks a lot for the call. Congressman Paul Ryan, Congressman Eric Cantor, Senator Jim DeMint. What's with these guys?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
They're willing to bring down a country. They're willing to throw millions of people into unemployment and poverty to get political power. That's wrong. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike in Salt Lake City. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yes, Tom, I have a question clarification for you. On the May 29th broadcast, you were talking about the Republicans in Iowa wanting to establish a maximum wage where they're going to tell the employers how much the very highest they can pay their employees. Did I get you correctly?
I don't know. I don't have my notes from that show. I was reading from the excerpts from the Republican Party platform on that day. I remember that, but I don't remember what the exact language was. So I can't,
Yeah, well, Tom,
verify that or not without having, digging through and finding out.
Right. Well, Tom, if it's true, then I'd like to ask the Republicans, if you're going to legislate to the employer a maximum wage that goes against, the Ronald Reagan, revolution for one thing. And then the second thing is, how do you think someone who is impoverished is going to go from rags to riches when you have a low paying job? You got to have a good paying job to go from rags to riches.
Well, not only that, you have to have a certain social safety net. Elizabeth Warren said it so well when she said, "None of us got where we are alone. There are no self-made men or women." That if you don't have a good public education, you're not going to go anywhere. If you don't have a reasonable health care system, then it's very difficult to become an entrepreneur or to step out and do anything other than just get a job that has health insurance. If you don't have safety on your streets, if you don't have, if you don't know that the fire department, the police department are working on your behalf or staffed. You've got Republicans now in San Diego and San Jose who are and even Democrats. I mean, part of the problem is that this Bush recession, this Bush depression is like just whacking. People are not paying income taxes because they're not working. They're unemployed. And so cities don't have money. And so without those things, you can't become part of the middle class. You can't be, to paraphrase Franklin Roosevelt, free. He said, a necessitous man is not a free man, if you don't have those core things. So I totally agree with you, Michael. Very well said. Thanks for the call. Andy in Minneapolis. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It is a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
So I've got this buzzword, this term that I use for people when they're asking me, what do I think the Republicans really are really all about?
Mm-hmm.
I won't say all conservatives, I will say Republicans. And it comes down to what I call the three S's. Keep them sick, keep them stupid, and keep them scared.
Yeah. I don't know about the keep them sick part, but, don't help them if they get sick. Certainly stupid and scared.
By not providing health care, you pretty much are keeping them sick.
Yeah, Yeah, it is very much the right-wing media agenda, and it's very much the right-wing congressional agenda, and it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. Sick, stupid, and scared. Good one, Andy. Thank you. Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate the call. Sean? Occupy site? No, is that Mark Taylor Canfield?
Yeah, Tom, it's Mark.
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
How are you? Good. Yesterday you had a poll on your website asking whether the Occupy Wall Street movement was finished. And I'm here to say that folks should be warned that indications of lack of corporate media coverage or direct involvement in the electoral process should not confuse people, because as of July 4th, there is a national Occupy gathering happening in Philadelphia, and there are Occupy caravans leaving from every, you know, major city on the East Coast and West Coast. Some of those caravans are headed to Washington, D.C. before they converge on Philly. But I'm hoping we'll be able to come up with a sort of declaration of independence from corporate influence on our government and our elections.
That's great.
And yeah, and I also have a quick report on the Washington State Democratic Party convention here. It took place this last week, and I was invited to speak before the Washington State Democratic Party Progressive Caucus. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that the grassroots really supports the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Democratic Party. But unfortunately, the leadership is really busy trying to raise the billions that will be necessary to keep Barack Obama in the White House. So they're a little bit preoccupied.
Yeah, and occupiers tend not to be United. Mr. Moneybags.
Yes, but another good news story, 16 occupiers had their trespassing charges dropped here in Seattle by Judge Judith Hightower after mm-hmm. she ruled that the building that they were occupying had been completely abandoned and was slated for demolition, so she didn't see any trespass charges there. This despite the fact, Tom, that the Seattle Police Department carried out a SWAT team raid on that warehouse back in December with heavily armed officers. Wow. And, you know, this definitely calls into question, you know, the heavy-handed tactics of the Seattle Police Department at a time when they've been under a federal Justice Department investigation for excessive use of force. So, you know, good for Judith Hightower, our judge, you know, to let those occupiers off, because basically she was saying that the building was completely unused, the ownership was in question, and there's no reason that those people should have been arrested.
Great. Great. I'm glad to hear that worked out, Mark. And thanks a lot for the report. Mark Taylor Canfield is blogging over at Huffington Post and other places. You can find his observations on the Occupy movement all over the place. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Tom. Keep up occupying the media. We appreciate it.
There you go. Thank you. Bill in Sacramento. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about low-information voters.
Mm-hmm.
You remember in Game Change when Sarah Palin was talking about the Queen of England being the head of government?
Yes.
Not the head of state?
Yes.
And now she said that Paul Revere ringing those bells instead of one by light, two by sea.
Right.
And people believe her when she was talking about austerity. I heard a friend of mine who's a very conservative said, well, Sarah Palin says we should have austerity. And I'm flipping out.
Mm.
I'm going, what are they talking about? And my question is, why do people believe this? I mean,
they believe it because you have billionaires and a very, very large and powerful media machine promoting the idea. The fact is, no country has ever cut its way to prosperity. Doesn't happen. But the theory is out there that if we just cut government smaller so that the tax bill that the Koch brothers pay became smaller, and if you got rid of those nasty government regulations that prevent coal-fired power plants from dumping mercury in Lake Michigan, that somehow that's going to make the economy better. And, you know, it's nuts, but it gets promoted by Fox News, it gets promoted by right-wing talk radio, it gets promoted on right-wing blogs, and it gets promoted by politicians who are in the bag of these same corporations that all the people, the aforementioned people, are working for. So, you know, it's the big lie theory. If you tell a lie that's big enough and audacious enough and you repeat it often enough, people will come to believe it. They'll say, oh, that's so huge. I mean, it must be true, right? Ronald Reagan came along and said, hey, if we cut taxes, more money will come into the government. And we were like, what, are you nuts? I mean, his own vice president called it voodoo economics, George Herbert Walker Bush. And you know, but you know, he said it often enough, people started thinking, yeah, cool, okay, cut the taxes, let's see government revenue go up. And he cut taxes, and what did he do? Ran up a $3 trillion deficit. George W. Bush comes into office, and you heard me play the clip earlier. He says, you know, we've now, you know, Bill Clinton left us on a trajectory where in 10 years we will have paid off all of the national debt that is possible to pay off. All of it. All of the debt that's not held by the government itself, we will have paid off. And you know, and then, you know, 6 months later, he says, hey, let's increase the government revenue by cutting taxes on rich people. And so he cut taxes on rich people. And what happened? You know, he left office with a $10 trillion deficit. He came into office with a $5 trillion deficit. And somehow the Republicans don't want to talk about that. But anyhow, that's the case. Bill, thank you for the call. Well said. Dean in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. The first time I've ever called you, I've been a big fan listening since 2005. I just spent so much time writing down notes while I've listened to you. I just haven't had time to call because I've learned so much from you. Anyway, the main reason I'm calling is Wisconsin. A quick note, though, on Obama, what he said today. I think he was absolutely right. The private sector is doing fine. They've got $2 trillion they're sitting on, but instead of using it to create jobs, they're using it to elect Republicans so they can
You're right.
their full
They have
wealth.
$2 trillion in the United States. They've got $3 trillion outside the United States, the U.S. corporations. They've got $5 trillion that they're sitting on and they're doing nothing with.
Yeah.
And you're right. They are using it to elect Republicans who will cut their taxes even farther and make it easier for them to offshore more jobs.
Yeah, but I'm Wisconsin. I haven't heard people talking as much as I think they should about the Obama supporters who voted against the recall and for Walker. The exit polls, you know, besides the 10-to-1 money advantage that Walker's campaign had over Barrett's campaign, the exit polls show that 17% of the Walker voters said they plan to vote for Obama.
Right.
That means one out of every six Walker voters. That's 1/6 to 53%. That's 9% of all Wisconsin voters were pro-Obama but against the recall. Walker won by 7%, 53-46.
Right.
Another exit poll, the overall that showed Obama 51-44% among the people who voted Tuesday in Wisconsin. Obama 51-44 over Romney. So to me, Obama voters against the recall made the difference, and I think they're very foolish because I have a hunch that they weren't. From what I've heard, and I made some calls to Wisconsin, but I talked mostly to supporters of the Democrats. But it seems like some of them thought it was too soon to recall Governor Walker, or they felt uncomfortable doing it. And I think they're going to live to regret it because maybe unless Russ Feingold runs, he's the only one that has the name recognition that maybe will prevent, you know, Walker's money advantage from being too much of a disadvantage. But I think it may be too late to get rid of Walker in 2014. I think they may have been their last chance.
Yeah, we'll see. We played this clip on Wednesday. I don't know, Paul, if you can grab clip number 7 from Wednesday. No, we're hitting the break anyway. But we played a Walker ad, and the main storyline of the ad, which was bought by those, I would say, probably, you know, low-information, weak Obama voters, but it was bought, which is that you should only take a sitting governor out of office if he's committed a crime, not just because you don't like his policies. And that was what was promoted very heavily, and I think it was effective. You're right. Thank you, Dean.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But pretty much anything can be effective if you put, you know, millions and millions of dollars behind it and you repeat it thousands, hundreds of thousands of times. And that's what Walker did.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Jacob Dean and Shane Farnham, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dow Global, commercially, Pacifica Radio, non-commercially, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. No, seriously, thank you. It's wouldn't be here without you. Elizabeth in Inkster, Michigan. Hey, Elizabeth, what's up?
Hi, I'm calling from, I'm the president of the United Nations for Animals, and I don't mean to bring bad news, but there's a crisis that's going on that's almost as serious as global warming, and that is that the corporation Monsanto, a multinational corporation, is proliferating genetically modified seeds, grains, fruit, and vegetables all around the world that are contaminating, wiping out the world's supply of natural and heirloom foods and plants.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're taking a whack at the pollinators too, if my reading of the literature is right.
Yes, the GMOs act like super weeds, and they rob the soil of all the nutrients, and the other plants, all the natural native plants, die. They won't grow, and it's leaving third world nations with no ability to grow their own crops. they have no income from farming. It's leaving their people to starve.
Yeah. I was on a conference call with Vandana Shiva a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about this, how farmer suicides in India are you know, I mean, it was big news 4 or 5 years ago. They're still going on. They're still.
Well, what they're doing right now is now Gerber Foods has bought grains and fruits that are contaminating the infant formulas and baby food sold in the United States. And another company, Kellogg's, everybody knows Kellogg's, they're using GMO grains in all their cereals.
Well, it's almost impossible not to come across GMO grains. I mean, something like 70 or 80% of the U.S. grain crop is GMO now.
Well, so what they need to do, really, is
we need to label it at the very least.
People need to get active and call these companies that are selling foods with the GMOs, ask them to remove them from the shelves.
Yeah.
If you see any GMO crops growing, to remove the crops, because the seeds from the stamen of the plant, it blows in the wind, and then it's cross-contaminating.
Yeah, and Elizabeth, you know, calling companies is fine. They will, by and large, ignore you because you're asking them to make less money. Calling your members of Congress and saying, we would like to, at the very least, have a label that says this product contains GMO food or GMO-contaminated food, or, like the European Union, simply say, you know, let's ban this stuff. You know, you haven't demonstrated it's safe. Let's ban it. And that's... Go ahead.
If you think about it, Tom, this is a form of corporate terrorism. It's actually an act of war on our world and its economies and food resources for their private profit.
Arguably. I'm sure Monsanto and Kellogg's and Gerber would give you a very different story, but I think that there is a legitimate concern about GMO foods. At the very least, let us know what we're eating. Elizabeth, thank you, and good luck on your work, and congratulations for your activism. Steve in Hollywood, California. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, sir, standing by. A senator started yelling at the farmers, I'm not going to bail out any farmers. Well, that pissed me into a corner to where I had to come up with a solution, and I agree that, and I'd searched, we have a right to make an amendment and make this a more perfect union to pay off the debt for an emergency situation that keeps the population out of calamity, you know, and it's an emergency situation, and it keeps them separated, of course, you know, with safety, but then the greed of the CEOs has to have a national code, like inspections, where the city code comes, inspector comes. But
what's your point, Steve?
I'm admitting an amendment to utilize funds to pay off the national debt and to start infrastructure, which will, the domino effect will fix the debt, saving $82 billion. It'd take 350 years, I already did the math, but to just create an amendment.
No, I think you're absolutely right that we
can do that.
Yeah, if we simply built our infrastructure, we would pay off the national debt because you would see such a revival of our economy that the tax collections would go up, you know, assuming that we went back to Clinton-era tax levels. Jack in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Hey, Jack, we got a minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
Tom, I'll go real quick. Your statement earlier about we might be at the tipping point soon around the climate change
put
me right out of my mind. And then when I hear about these Republicans and what they're doing to keep us focused on the economy in such a negative way, good. Focus on the economy. Then we don't have to think about climate change. We don't have to think about all the things we need to fix.
Yeah.
So I think when you say treasonous, I think you can add that they've diverted us from global warming since the 70s.
Yeah, they're traitors not only to their country but to their species.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's a scary thing. I'm sitting here looking at my grandchild thinking, holy, I mean, this is crazy that it's being allowed. And how do we stop it? It's, you know, we fight and fight and fight politically. And they criminally keep just indicting this country and destroying it.
Yeah.
So we're in a crisis beyond a crisis.
You know, one of the stories that doesn't get enough coverage is that I believe it's 8 northeastern states put into place a cap and trade law or policy back a couple of years ago, and it's actually worked. It's reduced carbon emissions by 30%, as I recall, in that neighborhood. We need to be talking more about the solutions. Jack, thank you for the call. Coming up next on the Tom Harbin program, coming up Monday, they say everything is bigger in Texas. Unfortunately, that includes teen pregnancy statistics. We'll have a rumble with conservative Heather Surmo about how absence-only education is working or not in the Lone Star State, plus your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it. see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.